Welcome to today's episode of Artist on Air with someone who has 25 years of experience in B2B SaaS and is now the CEO of Gillian, Oscar Werner.
I try this, you put so much heart into it that you want it to work, but you got to be like, and then you're not intellectually honest with yourself because you want it to work, it should work, right? So try it, but be intellectually honest to yourself to say it did fail, and acknowledge that. Acknowledge that to the entire organization. Be open about it to your founders. This one did fail, but we'll do this. Then what am I going to learn from that? And learning maybe leave the market altogether. Hard decision. I've done that a couple of times. Every time I've done that to focus on what does work, it's good. But it may also be, and there's no general rule, it may also be, well, try it again, but in another way.
Today's guest is Oscar Werner, who is looking back at 25 years in B2B SaaS. He started his career as a founder and entrepreneur in the late 90s and moved on to hold various VP and CEO positions in B2B software companies. Oscar helped to scale VR and AR technology Tobii from 20 to 120 million in revenue as a VP before joining publicly listed company Sinch. And they grew their revenue from 300 million to $3 billion, so by 10x while he was CEO. I asked him how he did that, how he built the revenue org, how he hired the team, what went well, what went wrong, and what he's learned from the mistake over the years. That was fun. Now he returns from the US to Stockholm to build Gillian into the leading provider of growth debt for tech companies. Some of you may still know the company under their old name R Capital. They specialize in loans for tech companies between 1 and 10 million ARR and are basing their funding decisions on a wide range of data that the borrowing company provides via a software platform. I wanted to understand whom he is challenging with that, how big the market is, and what drives him. Join me in the conversation with Oscar Werner now and join Oscar along with many, many other software founders and executives at the Artist Summit in October. See you there and let's listen to you now. Let's get this interview started.
Artist on Air, der SaaS-Podcast für den deutschsprachigen Raum. Wertvolle Tipps von erfolgreichen Gründern, Top-Investoren und führenden Industriepartnern, die euch bei der Skalierung eures Unternehmens schnell und unkompliziert weiterhelfen. Zusammengestellt von Janis Bandorski, Julius Göllner und Matthias Ernst.
Hi Oscar, welcome to Artist on Air.
Thank you, Janis. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Are we finding you in Stockholm today?
We're finding us in Stockholm.
That's cool. Oscar has been in B2B SaaS for, I think it's 25 years now, and bounced around quite a bit in the US and Europe, but now back in Stockholm. I'd like to go a little bit into what you've been doing before you became the CEO of Gillian now, because I think that was a very profound position you had there. You came on board as the CEO of Sinch. And maybe you can talk a little bit about what is Sinch actually, what are they doing, and what was your role there, Oscar?
So Sinch is it's called a CPaaS or communication platform as a service company. So basically, if you as an enterprise want to send an email, you want to send a text, you want to do a voice call, you want to send a WhatsApp message to your consumers, then we would provide a platform to do so. So customers would be like Commerzbank, Deutsche Bank, Deutsche Bahn, etc. Also selling Uber. If you call Uber, we would connect the call. Or if you get an email from US Post, we would send the emails for US Post.
Does that sound like your customers were mostly enterprises that operating on an international scale then?
Yeah, I mean, we started out, actually it became a very large set. We brought the company to $3 billion revenue. So it started with enterprises, but then we added what we call big tech. So the Googles and the Amazons, the Microsofts of the world were a core customer group. But we also expanded into developers. So we had 100,000 developers on the platform, and that could range from a one person company all the way up to the developers of Microsoft's developing something new. And we had an online service for SMEs, like the founder of an SME company, five company, and the founder wanted an online service to send text messages. So we had a very wide array, and we also had partners like Oracle, Adobe, SAP on the platforms. We had a very wide array, ranging from a one-person developer all the way up to Microsoft as customers, and we had to segment our go-to-market in a relatively elaborate way to make that happen.
So that's a pretty broad range of customers there, and building a $3 billion software business is quite the feat. That's the number that Sinch had when you left the company, I think. But I'd like to go back to the beginning. How did they find you, and why did they think you were the right person to take Sinch from where it was when you started to where you took it when you left the company and took your next step to Gillian?
Yeah, so they found us. Sinch was $300 million revenue when I started. They found me because I had worked with the founders before.
So that means basically you 10x the revenue while you were there.
Exactly. The story of Sinch, I got in, it was $300 million revenue. It was a European one product only. We only did text messaging primarily in Europe. We had entered the US, but it was primarily a regional play. Then we went on to a very strong growth journey. So over 4 years, we took the revenue from $300 million to $3 billion roundabout. We took the number of customers from maybe 3,000 to 150,000 paying customers. We took the profit from $30 million to $350 million and the people from 300 to 4,500 roundabout. And that's like half of that is organic growth and then half of that is M&A growth. So it was quite a scaling journey.
Yeah. How many acquisitions happened in those 4 years that you were there?
So we did 15 acquisitions during those four years. So it's a very interesting meeting we had when we said, all right, so we started at $300 million and then we said, We scaled the company. We got it to $500 million on 500 people, $50 million profit. And we did that organically. And when we got you had the organic growth engine working in a good way. And we were growing 30% year on year roundabout. And we said, hey, who's the biggest player in this space? It was Twilio, which I assume many of you know, Silicon Valley unicorn, if you will. And we said, how do we outgrow Twilio? If we do that, we got to do something more aggressive than 30%. So what if we add an M&A vector to this? We listed 10 companies and we said, what if we managed to acquire five out of these? Then we would be we'd be a company with $100 million profit, B2B SaaS in Europe, great cash conversion, growing at 60, 70%. And we would be buying companies that were profitable at an accretive valuation. So that would be, we found that attractive and attractive propositions. And so did our owners. So they were starting. And when you start on that type of journey, you can't really see the end, right? But it's every step was pretty logical. And we got to a pretty good place as us and Twilio being the leaders in the space.
What is the big unlock to have a big vision or a big dream like that to challenge Twilio and to grow a company to that scale? Because to be quite frank, I think that is something that we are sometimes lacking in European founders, that they don't have the mindset to think, how can I get to 5 billion in revenue?
Yeah. No, I think what is the unlock? It is really dare to do it. Dare to believe you can be a global leader. Dare to believe you can beat the big American companies. They're not better than Europeans. It's very much in the mindset. It is so much in the mindset of really daring to do it. If anything I'm preaching is, if you have a good plan, if you have a good business, you should dare to go all the way, right? We don't have to sell out to Asians or Americans when the company is like 1 billion valuation. You can go for the big run if you want.
A short update from our partner PSG Equity. The team with a focus on B2B scale-up completed its 500th add-on acquisition last month. That's a strong milestone for the team and proof of the implementation of this powerful instrument in the growth phase for investments worldwide. According to PSG, add-ons are just one of the many ways to help founders accelerate the growth of their software companies. Acquisitions should therefore strategically strengthen or expand the core business. What additional pain points does my customer have, and can I expand my range of services to solve them? It's important to create a functionally integrated company that enables revenue and profitability growth. Having supported more than 140 companies and brokered 500 add-on acquisitions, PSG has extensive investment experience, deep expertise in software and technology, and a super strong commitment to working with management teams. And you have the chance to meet PSG Software's investment teams at many Artist Summit pre-events and, of course, at the Artist Summit in October. For more info, head to psgequity.com.
Take us back to the time when you started working with the founders of Sinch. You had mentioned that was your first touch point with the company. Did they already have that vision that they really wanted to build a billion-dollar company, or is that something that you brought in into the conversation, or how did that evolve?
No, they did not have that vision equally strongly at that point. So I think that's something we did together with the owners and the main investors and the founders and the management team, including me, of course. So I think we developed that. But I think one of the skills that I think I have is unlocking that the ability to think that big, right? So really, really painting the picture. And it's not only me, it's really the founders and the owners, but painting the picture, where do we want to get to? And really painting that and knowing, all right, that is a good position. And if it is a good position, then putting the plan in place to get there. I remember one of the founders saying in an early interview, this was a public company when I took it over, right? So, but in an early interview, he said, you know, gee.
Were they listed on the Nasdaq Nordics?
Nasdaq Nordics, exactly. Yeah. So, okay. So, but he said, gee, is this guy talking about my company? What's his quote to me? Which is a little bit funny, right? So, but I had a really good base, right? They had built a phenomenal company. So it was a lot of like setting the strategy and daring and also articulating the story in a good way. So, but I remember when I'd done that to a set of investors, he was like, geez, this guy really talked about my company. That sounds really cool.
Right? Yeah, right. And Oscar, is there, you're saying it takes that mindset. Is there a moment you remember earlier in your youth or where you picked up that skill to think big, and when you first took a leap that felt a little bit too big to take?
I think it's a function of a long career in tech, right? Having been in B2B SaaS for 25 years, right? And having done that and having been surrounded by people who think the same way. I done a similar journey, like, you know, there was one of the, you know, Toby, which was before Sinch, we took from 20 million to around about 120 million.
I think you have to say one sentence to what Toby is and what they do.
Toby is an eye tracking company. So basically, if you look on a computer, we would know where on the screen you're looking. And we would be selling that to people, on the one hand, to people with disabilities. So you have CP or Rett syndrome, you can't speak. And then we built an entire computer with a software on it, and we attach an eye tracker, and then you can look on a screen and you look on first H and then E and then L and then L and then hello, and you type hello. So it's a communication device, med tech, medically classed, right? With both hardware and software and eye tracking. So, and then we also sold it to the Googles and the Microsofts and the Sonys, if you will. So if you buy a Sony PlayStation VR headset today, it has Toby eye tracking built into it. That's one of the most well-known customers, right?
Right. So, okay.
So that is what Toby is. And we did a similar journey there, right? But it was 20 to 120. That's a good journey. But having been in that area and having been with founders and people who think big, you eventually develop the mindset of you can actually truly win in the world and really, really have that mindset. And that's something I really want to propagate out to your European founders, that they actually can, right?
All right. And I think, so if I'm getting this right from you, you have been hired or brought into teams that were high performing and that were very daring. But then again, at Sinch, you were, as the CEO, you were in the position to build out the executive leadership team and to build a team of really strong regional leaders and functional leaders. What is your main philosophy in building really strong teams? What are you looking out for in candidates and how they should work together?
So I think the most important thing in leadership and in building a team, it's obviously the people. You have to be a strong recruiter or able to attract and know who you are going to assemble around you. I think that's getting the strong team. How you do that, I think it's individual to you, because
How do you do it, Oscar? How do you do it? And what does that mean more specifically? You have to be a good recruiter.
So I think you got to be, it's a couple of things, right? You have to know and understand the skill sets that you're really looking for. I don't want to be an expert in the field, but I got to know enough in the fields to understand what is a good CFO? What is a good, CTO? What is a good CPO? What is a good VP of sales? And I think as a CEO, it's good if you have a broad experience, so you can actually judge what is good, right? If you don't, I think you should bring on somebody else that you trust that has in the recruitment process that really goes deep into it, ideally with a stake. I mean, it can be a board member or something that can judge if this is a good person for this role, right? Because it's a lot of, the interviews say a lot of things, but it's much more the pattern recognition. It is, you know, because you kind of feel it because you've seen this type of roles before. I typically think about, even if I can't recruit, what is the ideal profile? And think, I exemplified with three candidates that would be good in this role. And then you try to find somebody that is similar to that, because that gives you a pattern of what you're looking for. Then in many times you don't get that exact, but you have a pattern that you're looking for, and you go for something that is a little bit different, but that's kind of orients you to the right people, right?
So is that more towards hiring for talent because you know that the person can do it, or is that more hiring for past experience and the person has already proven that he or she can do what you want them to do in their next role?
That's a great question. I think the highest predictor of somebody being successful in a role is if they have done it before. So that is the most likely that they will succeed. On the other hand, I like hiring for talent because I like hiring up and comers. I think I use both of those, but I probably don't. In a management team, I would do a mix of them. So some are I know it will work, and some are up and comers, and that type of mix is typically very, very strong.
All right. Okay. Then let's dive a bit more into that, and let's take a very specific example that many of our listeners are interested in. Let's talk a bit more about building out the revenue function. Yep. If we take that as an example, because I know that at Sinch you've built a dedicated sales organization also. That was one of your responsibilities. You segmented that into many different customers, into many different countries, and then you wanted to have people who do an excellent job in their specific area of expertise. So I'd like to know, how did you think about building out a revenue function at Sinch? And then how did you hire specifically for expanding the revenue in that function?
Yeah. So if we take Sinch, where we started with, we were starting selling to resellers only. So we're kind of selling to other companies that were reselling our services, right? We sold mass capacity of email or voice calling or text messaging to them, and they were selling it to different enterprises. So that's
they're building it into their product then?
Well, they could build it into their product, but they could also just be, I am a local local team in Colombia, and I was addressing the Colombian enterprise ecosystem. Or we had, 15 players in Germany who were then selling on to the German enterprises.
Okay.
So yep, it may not be that they added that much value on top, but they made a connection and they resold our services. So that's where we started.
Okay.
So the first thing was then to say, all right, so we have that, but we, in order to have more stickiness in the customers, we need to address enterprises and switch to selling directly to enterprises, going to Deutsche Bahn or Deutsche or Commerzbank or Deutsche, all these enterprises directly. So the first thing is
the big ducks companies.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So the big enterprises, right, of the world. And then we were very specific in, okay, to do that, we need to bring in a team that has done that. So we were looking for enterprise SaaS software salespeople and gradually started to build out that function. Obviously, with that comes, is there a channel conflict between the resellers and us? And we were just like, we in that model, there's always going to be some channel conflict, right? Some people were afraid they were all going to leave. Eventually, they did not, because if you're really clear on what you're doing, so we will address these type of companies directly, but we have no problems if you address them as well. And we're sure that you are adding some value-added services on top of us. Because if you don't, well, fine, there's no real value in between, right? But we believe that if you add some value-added services, which may, by the way, only be relation, because in many cases, it's about the relation. So we're fine with you doing it. We're not going to try to address the companies that you have, but we are going to try to expand our market. So The first thing we did is really honing in and building up the skill set for enterprise sales.
So did you guarantee an exclusivity for the companies that a reseller had brought on board previously, that you said we're not going to touch that account for 12 months or 24 months or something like that?
We did not formally do that. It, you know, with many customers, that becomes very, very complex and a very, very complex discussion to have. Right. So we ended up not formally doing that.
How do you actually do it?
But on the other hand, we didn't intentionally do it, but sometimes the enterprises came to us and then we said, if they come to us, our view was, if the enterprises come to us and they want to deal directly with us, there is a reason for that. And then we will take them since we are addressing enterprises. If you want to keep them, we're all fine. But then you need to offer some type of service, product, you know, relation, something that makes them go there, right? But we have a clear strategy of going there. And I think as long as you're super clear to your resellers on that, they will find a way. Some will leave, but majority of them often stay since you're so honest about what you're doing.
Super, super interesting, that reseller strategy. What was typically the additional layer of value that the resellers or the best resellers would add? Would they undercut your prices? Were they offering a service level that you couldn't provide to the customers? Or how did they gain an advantage to stay in business?
So many of them had a software layer on top, like they did some other, they were focusing on, let's say, NHS in the UK, and they were building specific services that NHS did and we did not do, right? But they could also be just relation, or it can be that they were pulling together a set of other players doing something, or that they had another channel that we didn't have or something. So it could be a lot of different things, right? And we just created this very, you know, strong a narrative on, you know, anything that is cross-country, cross-segment, like in all the different segments of the market, that is scalable on a global level. Any functionality that is scaling on a global level and that is cross all segments, we will build. But we will not build anything that is like specifically focus on the finance industry, specifically focus on the healthcare, specifically focus on the, you know, whatever industry. And that kind of gives a good room. That's a very clear way for the founders to understand what we're doing in our strategies. And that, then they could focus their strategy over the years to, okay, but we will be focused on the healthcare industry. And they would focus their services on there, which made them good in that. So I think, and it's a very defensible position, right? Anything that is globally scalable across all segments, we will do. But you as a local player, that belongs lower down in the tech stack, right? While you as a local player, you need to find other differentiation.
Right.
It's almost as a guide for them to what they should do in their own strategy, right?
All right. I like that as a very specific example for a reseller strategy and then moving into those same accounts, but not competing directly with the resellers. I love it because it's so hands-on. Yeah. Let's go back then. Let's jump a few years back, because I'd like also to get some of your knowledge when you were scaling more from 10 million to 30 million, because what we have just described now is already a global enterprise business. Can you give some hands-on advice where you saw something that worked really well, taking a company from, let's say, 10, 20 million to the next step?
Yeah. Before that, I just touch on two other points on this area, because it's important then when you go back to the previous question. So the next thing we did was set up a specific team for addressing the big techs, right? So we Enterprise is one thing, and then addressing the Microsofts and the Amazon. We set up a dedicated team only to do that, because there you have to do so much more service to them, but the upside is super large. We kind of broke that out into a dedicated team. And then when we wanted to do the developer, I mean, developer go-to-market, we actually ended up, we tried ourselves, we failed multiple times, because it's a completely different DNA to address a developer than it is to sell to a reseller, a big tech, or to an enterprise. So we ended up, we can't do, we just failed time over time. And then we ended up acquiring a company that did that. So we acquired a mail company who was super good at mail and developer go-to-market.
What is mail? Email. We're talking where, yeah, okay.
Exactly. All right. So you want to send out mass emails, and there's services that do that, and we're one of the top in the world, right? So, and I think that's the lesson is really, it's very, very, very hard to get an enterprise sales lead to become an online go-to-market for developers. It's very, very, very hard. It's very hard to combine the skill sets. Whatever lead you have there, that you have the both the online developer go-to-market and the enterprise sales go-to-market. Right. So you were really good
in the enterprise go-to-market. You failed a few times in the developer go-to-market and then decided, okay, maybe the right way forward is an acquisition here of a company who's already really good in that. And then they also sell to your new services to the same developers they've sold to before.
Exactly.
Did I get that right?
Okay. Yeah, and to the same companies, like to Microsoft, we were addressing them via the big tech team and had the big account. But then Microsoft is innovating 50,000 or however many developers they have. They're innovating constantly, and they were addressed via the developer team. So you have a multiple strategy to all companies because they have different behaviors. It's more about the buyer persona than the actual company size, because you may address them in different groups with different ways, right? But I think the real learning is you don't have to do an acquisition, but you have to get leaders in that knows developer go-to-market and enterprise go-to-market. If you want to do both, you have to have specific competence in both of these areas, and it's very hard to combine them, right? So the org structure is you almost have to have two leads, right?
Right.
And then we did the same in... So developer go-to-market is one go-to-market. That's like you're selling to the engineers, selling an API, and they connect. And it's like, the web page is like, it's a code. And the trick there is you got to get online like 60 seconds to value, right? You have to send your first text message within 60 seconds of signing up. That's kind of, you need to be that fast because you need to deliver value so fast. So that's one. But then you're selling to developer, and then we wanted to sell to people with SMBs, but we wanted to sell to the CEO or the founder with the user interface. And we tried to do that as well via developers, but we couldn't do that. So then we actually acquired another company to do that go-to-market only, to a kind of a business user online go-to-market, because that's very different from a developer go-to-market. So at the Sinch scales, you can do acquisitions, and at the smaller company, you have to hire the people, but that is also a very, very different go-to-market with a different skill set than the developer go-to-market, even if they look very, very closely. So I think the main lesson there is really honing in on, if you want to do two of those, you got to have leaders that knows exactly what you're doing and splitting the teams so that you actually have a different entire strategy and go-to-market strategy per user category, right?
Right. Okay. Well, then I'm trying now to translate this into today's world, because you said that since you've tried again and again and again to try to sell into the developers market and you failed. Now we're in times where efficient growth has become kind of the mantra. And I don't know if you get two or three attempts to fail. What would you recommend? How can founders today try out something and have the ability to dare to make mistakes and fail, but on the same hand, balance that with the investor's need most of the time to also do that very efficiently?
I think you have to try and you have to fail. There's no way of building a business without failing. I think there's one thing you can't do, right? It's okay to try. It's okay to fail. But it's not okay to do the second mistake, and that is not to acknowledge that you fail. And it's not okay to do the third mistake, and that is, not to learn from your acknowledgements, right? So It's if you do it, you fail. You got to have the intellectual honesty. And I made this mistake so many times, right? To say, I try this. You put so much heart into it that you want it to work. But you got to be like, and then you're not intellectually honest with yourself because you want it to work. It should work, right? So try it, but be intellectually honest to yourself to say it did fail, and you know, and acknowledge that to the entire organization. Be open about it to your founders. This one did fail, but we'll do this. Then what am I going to learn from that? And learning maybe leave the market altogether. Hard decision. I've done that a couple of times. Every time I've done that to focus on what does work, it's good. But it may also be, and there's no general rule. It may also be, well, try it again, but in another way. But I think it's okay to fail. It's not okay not to acknowledge you fail. It's not okay not to learn from acknowledgements. That's the rules I try to play by.
All right. Okay. And now going by those rules, when you put yourself back into that decision where you try to crack developer sales, how would you approach it differently today with what you have learned now on the next iteration, so to say?
I would have split the teams. I would have brought in a leader that had done that, that had the experience. In that case, I would not take an up-and-comer because we did not have the DNA. So I would have brought in somebody who has done this before, and I would have allocated enough budget to them to get to the MVP stage to prove. And I think we did the main mistakes was we did not bring in the true competence, and we did not give them enough to get to MVP. And enough doesn't have to be that much, right? It's enough to credibly get to that stage. But you got to do it with a competence, somebody who's done it. So that's the two mistakes. We made too little money and too little competence in that area. And well, you may say that's a rookie mistake, and it probably was. And I'm probably going to make the same mistake again tomorrow, but I'm going to try not to.
No, but this is a very beautiful segue, Oscar. Thank you for that, because obviously in scaling companies in the way you have done requires funding. And when you say you did not allocate budget, that implies that you also need to find a source of funding. And then we all know that around the 2000s, it was rather easy to get funding if you had an ambitious plan. But also the wind has changed there, and the funding landscape has become much more diverse. You've chosen to abandon your role at Sinch to become the CEO of Gillian now. And they're also involved with funding companies and help them in their growth. So maybe you can dive a little bit in that. What is Gillian's position in helping tech companies how to grow? What options are there? And then maybe as a second follow-on question, what brought you to go with Gillian and what convinced you?
Yeah, Gillian provides loans or debt funding to growth stage companies from 1 million ARR up to 10 million ARR. So that's kind of the range we're typically going. We're going to grow up to larger stages, later stage. But we do this as a tech company ourselves. So we're basically saying, hey, debt today is provided by little data and old data, basically balance sheet and P&L that you send to the bank like 45 days after month end. So we say, what if we connect to all the data sources that a company have and bring in, that can be your Shopify account, it can be your Google AdWords account, it can be your accounting system, your open banking system. So we get millions of data rows. So we connect to your systems. We only listen to the data you have. That means we gets millions of data rows or data interest per day. We know exactly when you're selling, but that also, so we're creating that platform, but with that platform, we get better confidence in your performance, and therefore we can give either loans to companies earlier than a bank would give because you don't have the history of the cash flow or the performance, right? Mm-hmm. But we can also dare to give money longer and more money longer than traditional players because we get bigger loans that it can get with traditional other banks, right? So that is what we're doing. And I think that the principle, I love the principle of Gillian, which is, hey, debt should be made of lots of data and real-time data because then you understand you understand the companies better and the companies get that back in a benefit with more money and longer. So that is what we do.
Right. Okay. And that means you're, when you're saying you're mostly servicing companies who make between 1 million ARR and 10 million ARR and have ambitious growth targets, or who are growing. That's a completely different ICP than the customers you've served at Sinch. What keeps you on the tip of your toes that you still understand the problems of founders and can put you in the position of rather early stage founders who require your services now?
Yeah, just as a minor, we did serve, we had like 50,000 customers in this space via the online services. So it's similar, right?
Okay, right.
Mm-hmm. So we did serve. So I've got quite a bit of experience here.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I thought you were mostly occupied with the enterprise, with the large accounts.
No, we did grow into this area, right?
So right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And sorry, now I forgot the question. I was so excited about answering the first one. Sorry about that.
I mean, you've started founding SaaS company yourself 25 years ago, yeah. And now 25 years later, what keeps you in the position to still understand the everyday problems of founders who seek your service, who are in the stage, or who are facing the challenge of scaling their company from 1 million ARR to 10 million.
I think, you know, with that experience, you know, that I have, it's like, it's super clear to me. And I've done in so many VCs, so many funding rounds, so many situations where you're short on cash and the VCs, like, you can get money, but you go do it for a down round. Or it's so clear to me that as a founder, you should have a diversified capitalization strategy in your company, right? It's so important to make sure you have enough capital to do what you do. And I think what I mean with the diversified capitalization strategy is like you should have, obviously, I mean, you're a growth stage company, you'll bring in the VCs, you bring in the equity capital because that will make you grow, unless you're, you know, super cash flow positive, but many want to bring in equity capital to do that. I think that's a really, really good base that a large set of companies should use and are using. So all supportive of that. I also think you should complement that with, you need a set of VCs. So when you go there and need more capital in this because you have this need, you need two or three or whatever you do. So you're not only dependent on one of them, because that one, their fund may going out, or they may not like you, or somebody's leaving your VC. So you need a subset of them in order to have good routes of funding, good routes of the funding company. But to complement that with a debt funding partner, which has a different view of life, which can say, okay, your numbers now look great. You think that if you run this company for 18 months, you reach the next ARR bracket and you get the higher valuation, it is better for you to bring in the capital like 12 to 18 months later, but to do so, but your numbers are stable. You're predictable. You know that you're going to get there, right? If you have a high risk, you shouldn't go to that funding partner. But if you feel your business, you trust your business, and you believe we're going to trust your business, then it may be very, very good to at times bring in that funding partner. You run for 12 more months. You get the higher valuation, less dilution. You can bring in more money. That's a very, very strong use case for a founder. Or it may be so. Another case would be, you are in a, it's a rainy day. Your numbers aren't going the way they are. Your equity partners are seeing that, and then they want to press down the valuation so you can bring in money, but you get a really low valuation. Many, I think, all founders have been here, right? Trying, been in that situation.
Many of the people who have had their company more than 3 years, they know what you're talking about. Yeah.
In such situations, it's super good to have a debt funding partner on the cap table, because we don't do dilution, right? But if you have strong numbers, even if you're flattish, or you're growing less than your equity partners want, or we can go in and provide you with the, you know, X million dollars that will take you through this lull and get growing again. You don't have to take the down round from the VCs, and we don't care about equity. We're a clean deal, right? We're 100% non-dilutive. So we can take you to the position where you're better again, and then you do the equity round at a better stage, right? So I think, having done this a couple of times, capitalization in the company is so important. It's like CEO, board, CFO work. Not bringing in or working with all parts of the capitalization structure is very, very strategic, right? So I would do that, you know, funding a company. I would do that again in order to have different alternatives for different types. And I would bring it in a little bit early, even if it's at the low base, at the low start, because then you have the option, you built up the trust with this funding partner, that funding partner early on, you can use them when you feel in need, right?
All right. And when you're putting yourself in the shoes of a founder and you're looking at various options where to take debt from, what would be the main criteria to choose the right partner from your obviously biased point of view, but what would be most important to you?
Most important thing is trust.
Right. So because I'm giving you all my data. I'm uploading all my most sensitive KPIs. And how do you build that trust with founders?
Yeah, so and I start with the founder perspective. The most important thing is trust, because you need to trust that this partner will treat you well on a rainy day, right? Debt is more risky, you know, more upside. You keep more of your equity yourself, but it's a little bit more risky because you have a debt funding partner you need to work with, right? So you need to know or have a good confidence that you will hit your numbers. But then we all know on a rainy day it doesn't work out, your lower ARR growth or whatever. Then you want to know that you're working with the founders that sees the world in the same way as you and that will act trustworthy in that scenario, right? The reason you would go to us is we build a platform and we look at SaaS metrics. We don't look at what the bank would look like, solidity or those type of numbers which are akin to you as a SaaS founder. We would look at ARR, churn, retention rates, etc. So we would come to you early on a rainy day and say, hey, your churn has gone up. What are we going to do now? I mean, we're interested in being paid back the loan, but we would say, all right, your churn has gone up. What are you going to do? What's your plan to address it? But it's going to be on your own terms. It's going to be at the same things that you care about, because you don't want to run your company onto the ground anyway, right? And then the founders may say, okay, no, I'm going to reduce cost. I'm going to reduce spending here. Or they may say, well, you know, all right, but I want to keep on growing here, and therefore I will bring a little bit more, I cure the breaches, you know, with bringing in a little bit more equity. Actually, I see that, but the reason is I churned a big customer, I just signed a new one, and then we're perfectly happy with that. So I think we early have a good discussion with the founders on their own terms about how they get their company on you know, in a good situation then. But it's on their own metrics.
Do you see yourselves as strategic partners, or because you don't take formal board seats, you don't take equity, but you are interested, you have a very strong interest that the company is doing well and growing. So your interest is mostly aligned with the founder. But on what basis are you having those conversations?
No, I think we do. I think we are a financial partner to the founder that almost sassifies them, if you will, right? We talk about the right numbers. We give them a reporting tool so they get all the reporting, you know, the SaaS numbers, etc. But we also, I mean, if everything goes well, we don't have to. If they want to speak to us, they can, of course, and we provide that type of service. But if, you know, we do speak to them and coach them in how to do it, then we may help them to find other, you know, help them to find other avenues, because that is what we do. So we do become a partner to them and a long-term partner, right? Because we see the numbers all the time. So yes, that happens, and I think that's a value we provide.
All right. Then, so you mentioned trust as the first one. What's another one?
So we typically talk about trust, then we talk about convenience. You as a founder, you want to spend money building your company, right? You don't want to spend money on the back end.
I don't want to spend time getting the money.
No, exactly.
I want to spend the money building the company.
The money easy, yeah. Right? Unfortunately, there are players like me that needs to know that we can't just give you the money and you run with them and never get them back. That's our business model, right?
So, I get it.
But you want to spend as little as time as possible of getting the money. You want that to be as easy or straightforward, you know, as possible. So therefore, given that we're building our platform and you connect your data, we can more easily understand you as a company and have a good dialogue with you on a faster and quicker way than with a bank, right? Both because we look at the same metric as you, and because we upload it into the platform so it goes quicker, right? So pushing that down and making it as convenient as possible for founders is a core goal to us, so they can spend more time building their business.
Make it specific. Make it specific, Oscar. How long does it take from I'm learning about Gillian for the first time as a founder to I got money in my bank?
Yeah, so the quickest ones we do is like 3 weeks. But it typically takes a little bit longer, a lot of, because the founders has to go to the board and, you know, they got to, you know, get, you know, collect the data, or they need to get this approval, or they're looking at two different funding partners, or et cetera. Right? So typically what prolongs the story is the interaction, right? So they having to make their own decisions. But it can be like from 3 weeks, but it probably takes 2 months on average, something like that, to get the funding. But if you're really dedicated, you really know what you want to do, there's a lot of opportunity to push it down. But in that range would be the you know, normal.
All right. Now, if we differentiate between VC-backed founders and bootstrap founders, who do you prefer working with, and who's your typical customer?
We work with both, and we're very clear about that. We're not like venture debt that bets a lot on the VC and bailing them out. We work with the founders if we believe that numbers from the founders are good and predictable, right? So I would differentiate between, we wouldn't fund a company which is high risk, has the revenue 15 years out in the future, and they got to build this new factor, right? We do B2B SaaS, B2C SaaS with proven revenue and a good traction. It doesn't have to be, you know, because we can look at the data and the churn. So it doesn't have to be as long as the bank, but we need to see the good traction coming there. And we need to see that we're basically looking, is this a predictable business? Can you as the founder continue to run this business in a good case and in a bad case? And that we don't care at all. We are super happy to lend to bootstrapped, and we're super happy to lend to VC backed or only angel backed. So we do all of that range as long as we're predictable.
All right. And are you operating in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland? That's where most of our listeners are from.
Yeah, we're operating in Germany right now with local people, not in Austria and Switzerland as of today.
Okay, got it. So German founders who have a scalable model, who are in software B2B or B2C, who have between 1 million and 10 million in ARR, and what's normally the size of the first check you're transferring?
So right now we're doing up to 3 million euro checks, right? And that's going to increase pretty shortly up to some 10 million. But that's the ranges we're doing today. We have done up to 10 million. Right now we're focused on, from a diversification perspective, focusing on the smaller tickets. And so, but they were soon going to increase that up to 10 million. But right now 0 to 3.
And is that normally a single transaction, or are these multiple transactions over stretched up?
No, we can do multiples. We have most of our customers are coming, and then they, when they are good, they kind of request kind of more and more, and we just do the same thing, right? Do you look like a solid company? Have you grown? Does your number look good? And then we're happy to provide more capital.
All right. Then as a third factor, from my point of view, I've taken on debt financing in one of my previous companies too. And one of the factors I definitely looked into was rates. How do you compare your rates, your effective rates, to banks and to other providers of debt?
Yeah, so it depends where you are, right? So if you look at a bank, many of these companies, they wouldn't provide debt to these. So it's like a no.
Yeah.
And then in some cases, they do provide. I mean, the bigger cases or the higher growing or, you know, better. I mean, we sometimes end up in competition with the banks. Typically, what happens then is we win against the banks. The banks typically provide lower rates, but we provide more money. So typically we give like a 6-year loan with 2-year grace periods. You have no amortization the first 2 years, while a bank may provide a 0 grace and a 3-year amortization. So if you do that, we would say you can take the bank, but you'll have 2 years in, you'll have only half the cash than they'll have from us. Or so to, and take
so
it
that
back.
Means in the first 2 years, when I go with Gillian, I only pay interest, but I don't pay back the principal over
exactly.
The first 24 months, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then it get back to first principles, right? The reason you got to debt is that you wanted money on your balance sheet to do an M&A or to do growth. Or so in principle, you get the double amount of money compared to bank, but you pay a little bit higher interest rate. And that's a discussion. That's obviously a trade-off that we're very, very open and transparent with the founder. Either you take this or that, and we basically give them an Excel sheet of saying, you know, choose. If you want the money longer, want more money, you go with us, a little bit higher interest. But if you want the lowest interest, but not so much money, they go to the bank, right? That's
And what is the current average rate that founders have to pay you back at?
The interest rate. Mm-hmm. So we range around between 9-11% above STIBOR, Euribor, something like that. That's kind of the range that we're at, depending on size, growth, attractiveness of the company, right?
Right. Okay.
And if you take the others, compared to a venture debt play, right? They would typically have similar interest rates, but they have a warrant. Mm-hmm. So we don't take any warrants, right? So what you should do then, you should do your model, you do the interest rate, and then you add the dilution cost of the warrant. And with the dilution cost of the warrant, the venture debt players are much, much more expensive, right? And you could calculate that pretty easily with your base plan as well. What is the actual total cost of capital, including the warrant cost, right? Because that is dilution cost to take. And then we are much cheaper than venture debt. The other player that you get to is the RBF, or the revenue-based finance. So one, the first thing with them is in your ARR bracket, we provide they typically do like 40% of your ARR, and we can go up all the way to 100% of ARR. So we provide the double amount of money in your company side.
So very specifically, that would mean if I'm a startup now doing 1 million ARR, a revenue-based finance player typically would give me about 400,000, you would give me 1 million.
Something like that, right? Depending on your numbers. Like, so we typically give more money than the RBF players. The other thing with the RBF, they typically have a 1 year or 18 months, you know, payback period. So what you do is like, you take up this 400,000, you start paying back, and then you take it up again, you start to pay back, which if you would calculate the total cost of capital on that one, it's very, very high, right? So the effective rate would probably typically be like a 20% on them. So compared to an RBF player, we're typically more money, much cheaper. But you got to have the right numbers, right? But that's where we compare to them.
But you don't classify yourself as a revenue-based finance player?
No, because we're not tying the revenue to that, and we do much, much longer loans. Like the typical classic or revenue-based finance players do a 1 year loan. Now you're seeing some hybrids do in 18 months, maybe 2 years, right? But we do a 6 year loan. You don't do that on revenue-based finance selling your invoices, right? You were much more fundamental. You got to look at the company, right?
All right. I get
the last kind of comparison would be the getting a shareholder loan with a convertible. Mm-hmm. Where you compare, and the comparison there would typically be similar interest rate, but you got the cost of the convertible. So again, similar to venture debt, like the interest rate plus the convertible typically becomes very expensive. We typically, again, just do an Excel sheet to compare. You can see yourself what the total cost of capital becomes, and their total cost of capital becomes higher. And the other tricky thing with convertibles, according to me, is you get one of your owners caring both about equity and debt, and you get like a, how is this owner going to act on your board when you want to grow the company and they have a board seat and they care more about getting their debt back? It's a very, very convoluted situation to have that. And I rather than have, as a founder, I would rather have a clear board owner perspective. And then you have this debt player, which is us, sitting outside the board, but having acting only as a debt player. You know exactly how we act, right? We want to get our money back, and I think you can respect that as a founder. But we do it in order to help you to run your company, because the last thing we want is your company go back, because that is the highest likelihood we won't get the money back, right? So then we work with you to make sure you are on a good trajectory, so we get the money back.
So then I have one last technical question on that. Do you take any warrants or guarantees personally from founders?
Yeah, we do. We take covenants on it, right? So we set on your ARR, we take your base case, and then we set covenants on your ARR, which are way below it, maybe 30% below, 40% below, depending on your growth rate, right? So you need to grow above this rate, basically. And then we take a minimum runway covenant, which I assume you as a founder want anyway, right? You don't want to be like 1 month before not paying salaries anyway. So we have a set of months that we want you, a minimum runway of X months, basically. And these two, like you see, these two are things that you want to do anyway. And then we come
that makes sense. No, sorry, I didn't put my question very well. Let me reframe it. Do you take personal liability insurance or something like that from founders?
No, so never from founders. We don't.
If it doesn't work, my question is, if it doesn't work for me as a founder, I'm giving my best. Do I have to sell my house to pay you back?
We don't believe in that. We don't. Personally,
I don't have to sell my house to pay you back.
Sorry. No, I was misinterpreting the question. No, never. We never do that. I don't believe in that strategy. I would never do it myself. So I don't think any of the founders should do that either.
What? Because that's something banks do.
Exactly. No, but we don't. We don't think that's good, right? This is about a company transaction. We care about your company. You want to prosper. That's the best thing for us.
No more technical questions on debt financing then. But one more question about Gillian. How much is Gillian a debt provider? How much is it a bank? How much is it a tech platform? And how much is it a software provider?
All right. That's a very good question, actually. I never gotten that before, so I applaud you. I give that. So Gillian is not a bank. We don't have a bank license. We have other funding partners on the back of us that provides the capital that is a bank. So there are banks. So we're not a bank. We're called an arranger. So no, we're not the bank. So that's zero. We are then in between, are we a debt provider? Yes, that's a big part. Are we the second category, was that a software, building the software? So we're definitely, you know, equal parts a platform builder that builds a platform for us to understand you, but we also turn that platform for you to understand yourself, right?
So we're looking at the same data. You look at exactly the same data as the founders you work with.
Exactly. So you can see, like, our CTO was the head of analytics at Spotify. He knows how to build a platform to analyze a company on a second by second basis. So we're doing that with our entire tech team, only focusing on understanding your company. And then we turn that platform both to our own credit team to understand it, and then turn it to you. So you, for free, if you take a loan, get an analytics platform of your own. So you see the same data, but you also get value to yourself. So that is kind of half of the company and half is a debt provider. So we're kind of both.
Got it. That's an interesting position, I think, because some of the revenue-based finance providers have platforms like that as well, right? But they're serving or catering to a totally different category of the market, because you explained that you have more flexibility in the fund size, you have a much longer duration of your loans normally. Is that where did you get that idea, that CFO cockpit or KPI cockpit? Is that something that comes from the revenue-based finance providers, or from the Spotify dashboard, or how did that form up?
No, I think it comes from our founders, right? So I should not take the credit for the idea, but I love the idea. That's why I'm here. But it's not my idea. So it comes from our founders. I think it comes from we have three founders, right? One is a serial entrepreneur, this is a six or seven company. So he's done, and I think five of them are in fintech. So he's seen a lot of those type of business models. So that's kind of part of it. The other one is the tech guy, you know, been head of analytics, first at McKinsey, then head of analytics at Spotify. Then he built at EQT, one of the biggest, you know, PE houses in Europe. He built Motherbrain, which is a sourcing engine for EQT. So he built that. So coming from Spotify, EQT, and then McKinsey was like, okay, good breeding ground for thinking that's good. And the third founder is a banker coming from he built the startup and growth team at Nordea, a big Scandinavian bank, and he kind of built it up, did a couple of hundred loans, and then it's like, but hey, we can do this much better if we build a tech platform that actually helps us assess the loans. So put these three people together, and it's somewhere in the intersection is the business model, right? That's how it is. And I
totally
love that
sense,
fact.
Yeah.
That people with different competences combining, and the idea is in the middle.
Are the founders still active in the company?
I'm fully active, all three of them. So we have Oliver's chairman. He was previously CEO. He's the serial entrepreneur. Henrik is the CPTO, or product and tech officer. And then Axel is the head of our credit products, right? So fully engaged. We have a lot of fun.
Love it. Okay. And now going back to your ability to imagine big things, where is Gillian going to be in 4 years?
So what we really want to do is we believe that lots of data, giving credit at with lots of data and real-time data is a better way fundamentally to give credits. And at a massive scale, it's one of the biggest industries in the world, right? So we want to be the player that makes that happen at the global scale in the debt financing industry.
All right.
That is the thing. Mm-hmm. And we believe that that leads to us helping founders grow the growth ecosystem, the growth stage ecosystem in a better and faster way and keeping more equity to founders. So we want to increase the growth and keep more equity founders in the growth stage ecosystem. And I think that's since we're serial entrepreneurs, like very passionate about being close to the founders and helping the founders, really making them grow in that ecosystem. That kind of, if you see like the gravitas in the business, right? We love the tech, we're building the tech, but the gravitas is really helping the founders grow faster and keeping more equity.
And can you put that into one North Star KPI or into a metric that you want to have achieved in 4, 5, 6 years by 2030, having given out X amount of euros in loans or X customers?
Yeah, it would be two, because one is like we will have reduced the credit risk in the growth stage lending from 2% to something else, right? So that's the one metric on the lending side. And the other side, we would have we're gonna probably two there. Increase the growth in the growth stage ecosystem, make those companies grow faster. That is number one, so like, you know, in a percentage wise. And the other one would be increase the equity percentage that founders keep.
Okay, but you don't have a North Star metric like we want to have 10 billion assets under management or 10 billion or 1 billion or 100 million loans given out to startups or something like that.
No.
Well, you can say I have it, but I don't want to share it.
Okay. Because I think those numbers are small. If you succeed, I'm a more fundamental. I mean, you can get to there, right? But I'm more fundamental. I think that's super, super important when you drive a business. Like, if we succeed in reducing credit risk and making founders grow faster and making them keep more share of the equity, if we do that, if we focus on the true value we actually create, then we can do much more than you just said. So I think, you know, and that's a super, super important question when you're building a company, right? You've got to focus on the true customer value, and that's what we're trying to do.
And that will, in that case, that will take some time to prove, because you need entrepreneurs who can tell those stories with you that you actually help them grow their companies. So I think it's probably not linear growth, but once founders understand that, they see case studies or example of founders in their ecosystem where it has really worked, then that will probably see a lot of influx.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with time. We have lots of fun, and it's, you know, we're now building businesses, so that's not an issue. As long as we provide value, we're all happy.
Looking at the time, Oscar, I have one final or two more questions. One is, your company used to be called Ark Capital. Now it's called Gillian. What's the story?
The story is, try to Google Ark Capital and you get like a million hits.
That makes sense. Yeah.
So it was un-Googleable. So therefore, you know, we can't build a global brand that we own. And I think, you know, building a brand is like, it's like filling it with value. Mm-hmm. I typically sometimes take the example of Coke, right? So I lived in Atlanta for the last 4 years. So Coke is an Atlanta company, and Coke is the fourth most well-known word on the planet, right? It's right. Hi, Jesus, you know, something, and then it's Coke, right? So, and they build that other brand, Coca-Cola, which is crazy, right? It doesn't really flow off your mouth, right?
Right.
So you gotta have something that you own and can fill with something. And we could not own Ark because there are so many, so it's hard to fill it. So we needed something that we could own, and Gillian is good for that. It also means billion in old English, so has some connotation, but primarily it's like a word we can fill. That's the reason.
Okay, got it. And then we're at the very final question. We have a long list of restaurant recommendations from people who are in the B2B SaaS industry, and I want to know for which city do you want to give a restaurant recommendation today, Oscar?
So right as today, I would give it from Stockholm because I had a really, really good restaurant recommendation or restaurant experience 2 days ago with a funding partner, a US funding partner who came here. We went to AG or AG in Stockholm. It's a classic meat restaurant. I think they're ranked number 10 on the planet for meat. So really, really good. Okay. We had chef's table, and you get some seafood dish, and then you get excellent meat. You get Kobe beef. You get some Scottish beef, and I got like a Swedish dairy cow, which they made a thing of actually using dairy cow, and you compare it to Kobe beef and Scottish beef, and it's just as good. And I think that has a environmental touch, which is important to me. So that's very, very interesting.
Okay. And it's called ARG, like the first three letters of Argentina.
Sorry?
It's called ARG, like the first three letters in Argentina.
Without the R's, it's AG. It's only two letters, right?
Okay.
So I'd recommend that to anyone.
All right. AG in Stockholm sounds like a fun night, bit of the pricey option. You got to be a meat lover. And if you are, you can have a good experience there.
That's exactly.
Like. Cool. Thanks for your recommendation. Thanks for taking the time, Oscar, and for taking us through your really long career in B2B SaaS and into the details of Gillian. Thanks so much.
Love it. Thanks for all the questions.
That was my conversation with Oscar Werner from Gillian, who will also be back in Berlin for the Artist Summit on October 10th. Be sure to secure your ticket if you don't have one yet. We will be sold out, I guess. So I'm happy to see you there. Ciao, ciao.